All right. Well, good morning, Tech Ed. I see the hangover is still there. I will welcome everyone. My name is Chris Jackson. I am often referred to as the App Compat guy, which I think is a far more descriptive way to refer to my job title than the kind of titles that we normally give to folks, which are usually wrong and long and very unhelpful. It is my job to own application compatibility for the enterprise. So I work in the Windows space, so looking after Windows 7 right now, in the IE space, looking after IE9, as well as in the Office space, looking after Office 2010. And really fundamentally, I used to say that it was my job to kill IE6, Windows XP, and Office 2003. And then, of course, being from the US, I was quickly told that that is not politically correct, and so I need to refer to it as retire rather than kill, which I think takes a bit of the bite out of it. But that's what I'm out here trying to do. In our session today, we're going to be talking specifically about the browser and web applications, and we'll be looking at what's it going to take to finally get rid of IE6. What's it going to take to finally get people up to a modern browser that can do all of the great HTML5 stuff that we all would like to do? Now, before we begin, you may or may not know that TechEd is now an ad-sponsored event. So we're going to take just a moment for a word from our sponsors.
Hi there. We're here at Grady Memorial Hospital in Atlanta, Georgia, where in the night we secretly replaced this patient's blood with IE9.
Excuse me?
We wanted to find out if, after injection of IE9, he indeed became faster, cleaner, and more trusted. So first we'll see if Steven is faster as a result of IE9. Steven, can you please run down to the hospital entrance and back, please? Indeed, Steven is now faster. Actually, that could come in handy. Steven, could you quickly run back to Redmond? I forgot my phone there.
Let me know when you're gone.
All right, thank you, sir. Appreciate that. All right, now, Steven.
Yes, sir.
You are indeed faster. We now want to see if you are cleaner, right? Because one of the big benefits of IE9 is it gets out of your way. You don't even see the browser there. So let's see if that works. Wait, all right, let's see. My God, where did he go? Steven!
I'm here!
I don't even see him. Are you still there?
I am still here.
Completely invisible. So indeed, Steven is now cleaner. All right, so we've seen that Steven is indeed faster. He is cleaner. But the question is he now more trusted? So to try that out, we're going to give Steven the entirety of my child's college savings fund. Steven, here you go. You can just have that.
Chris, I can't take this.
No, you can have it.
I appreciate it, but this is yours. You should take it back.
That, ladies and gentlemen, is a trustworthy person.
Might I also recommend a good financial advisor if that is the complete nest egg that you currently have?
Internet Explorer 9. So you can be this guy.
Internet Explorer 9. Now with Tiger Blood.
All right, so that kind of sums up the main points that we are going after with IE9 and what we were trying to do to be a browser that was faster, cleaner, and more trusted. And presumably that gets sold to people who aren't geeks as having some business value and so on and so forth. I don't know about you, but not a geek is really a phrase that doesn't describe me at all. So before we really got into looking at the troubleshooting part, one important step, and a step that I don't think we always do well enough, is making sure that the geeks, the ones who are actually responsible for pushing your migration through, also understand and embrace the value prop of the browser. Actually want it, in other words. So I'm going to try and stay mostly over here on the demo machine today and skip as much PowerPoint action as I can, if that's okay. And normally what I like to do when I get into an area is take a look at how we're doing, and it looks like in Australia you're at about 2% market share of IE6, so that's quite well done. Things are not looking so hot up in China right now still, but things are awesome up in Finland, Norway, and Sweden, so figure out what their magic is. Let's start with faster. We talk about faster, and you know that's one of the really big design goals, and honestly, it was the number one complaint I heard about IE8 was, it's not as fast as the other alternatives that I have. And so I wanted to give just one example of how we've made the browser faster, and that is in the JavaScript performance. So the example I'm doing is a very JavaScript-intensive demo application that solves 5,000 Sudoku games, and it does so in about 1.1 seconds. Now, that number by itself doesn't tell you a whole lot, so I wanted to switch over to the 64-bit version of IE, because that's one of the questions that I get from a lot of my customers. Should I go 32-bit IE or 64-bit IE? Because I'm going 64-bit Windows. The answer is nearly always 32-bit. Number one, because there's not really much value proposition in going with the 64-bit browser. I don't know of any web applications that can make use of an address space in user mode of in excess of 2 gigabytes. So I don't need it to get anything done. And so then I think, oh, is it inherently better? Is it inherently faster? It turns out that one of the ways that we got the browser and the script engine to go much faster is by including a JIT compiler. So we're able to take the JavaScript code, compile it when you go to the page, and it's now all ready to run really fast assembly language. The JIT compiler is only on 32-bit Windows, because you can't just take that and port it. You have to write a new one. And since most scenarios would have gross incompatibilities, since most of your plugins only come in a 32-bit flavor, we never wrote one. And so in the 64-bit implementation of IE, we're still doing what we used to do in IE8 and earlier, which is interpreted code. Read a line, compile the line, run the line. Read a line, compile the line, run the line. And it turns out that that's about an order of magnitude slower than what we used to do. So we're certainly doing better than we used to on older versions of IE, and we're even doing roughly comparable to what we see in other browsers. So we've managed, in this case, we're even posting better numbers, but they're still of the same order of magnitude. I wouldn't, you know, quarrel over, you know, oh, I've got, 0.4 milliseconds when playing Sudoku. Scenarios are vastly more important. The net result is we've made it faster. We are now very competitive in that space. Just make sure you use the 32-bit version if you want all of the performance improvements. So it's faster and cleaner, and people show you all the UI features. I'm a nerd, so I'll show you the UI feature that matters most to me. How many of you have looked at a script lately? How many of you have debugged a script that looks like that? Debugging scripts that look like that is not terribly fun. Here's an awesome new feature in IE9. I can click this little drop-down menu here with these tools and say, Format JavaScript. Now that is something that I can read. That is cleaner from a nerd's perspective. And last but not least, more trusted. I'm able to feel more secure about my browsing experience with tools like the smart screen filter, which will allow me to notice that something I'm trying to download is bad, and go ahead and take that, since it's on the blacklist, and say, no, thank you. We've enhanced that for IE9 by also adding reputation. So now the fact that you haven't been marked as bad is not taken to infer that you therefore must be good. We also take into account, has anyone seen you before? Or are you completely new? So far, we have blocked over 1.5 billion malware downloads with this feature and counting. And another aspect of trusted is simply being more reliable. So let's say I had some kind of control that was crashing the browser. That we're able to recover from that crash and have that work naturally. So now I've got a more reliable experience. What's interesting is that... there we go. Let's go to this one. What's interesting is that I'm doing all of the demos today on real live internet sites. Some of them are production websites. So we stand the very real possibility that someone will fix them while we're here. I got my fingers crossed it doesn't happen too often, but it just happened on this one, so I went back to the broken state. Here's what I expected to happen. I expected it to not be broken. So I was giving this demo at TechEd North America, and I clicked on that link, and it didn't crash. And for once in my life, I wanted the app to crash, and it wasn't crashing for me. And as I always like to say, I can never end up having a failed demo, given the nature of what I do. I can simply have unintended debugging demos. And so we had an unintended debugging demo, and here is where I would branch into the app compat side of things is, why is this not crashing the way it's supposed to crash? Because that's the behavior I wanted. And I had to think about what would cause it to not load up and not crash. I've got a control, I had the control on the system. I know we moved it around because we made this demo site an Azure application. We're on sitting on cloudapp.net. And I had to think, what would make it behave differently? It's the same control, it wasn't recompiled, I know we just moved it, it was no longer loading and therefore no longer crashing. Aha! That reminds me, there's a feature that we put in place for IE8 that allows you to take an ActiveX control and specify which websites will I run on. Think about the power of that from a security perspective. From a security perspective, I can write a control, lock it in to only run on one site, and therefore, if I browse to another site, let's say there's a bug in it that I can exploit to own the browser. Someone else can't stand up a website, load your control, and exploit that bug because you can lock it in. So I thought about that, and I said, okay, let's take a look at exactly where we've locked it in, or even if we have locked it in at all. So there's a little utility you can download and install that includes this site list functionality that lets you dump the list of approved domains. All I had to do was, here's this class ID, we'll just paste it into the command line here, dump that out, and it will tell me that we have locked that ActiveX control because its job in life is to crash. So technically, someone else could load that, call the function, cause more things to crash. We didn't want that to happen. We locked it into ie8demos.com. We're not on ie8demos.com. We're on cloudapp.net. So we have to go back to ie8demos.com to get back to our crash. Faster, cleaner, and more trusted from a geek perspective. So I've just got a few slides, and I'm going to kind of hurry through them because I'm much more of a demo kind of guy. Some of the things I want to talk about, though, is kind of setting some baseline of what to expect and how I've seen people go faster. The lights are really bright, so show of hands is not going to be too helpful. Can we do by applause? How many of you are still at your company have some IE6 left? Okay. Ooh, a lot of you. How many of you are on 7? A few of you. 8? Anyone on 9? There we go. What are you doing here? We're going to geek out a little bit. I've actually helped a lot of people. One of the demos I have is from a problem I debugged this morning. So we'll hopefully they haven't fixed that yet. I posted the solution, of course. So what we look at is, how much are things going to break between the different versions? And our number one concern is 6 right now, because 6 is blocking a ton of people. It's one of those candle on both ends kind of problems. I got stuff that only runs on 6, and I've got stuff that absolutely refuses to run on 6. What do I do? Getting rid of 6 is important, and the first question that people ask is, well, how much of my stuff am I going to have to touch? Because I need to go and ask someone for some budget. On average, what we find is that it's about a quarter. Some people are better, some people are worse. That's the problem with statistics. As they say, there are lies, damn lies, and statistics. There's a lot of variability. What's important, though, is by getting some of the low-hanging fruit out of the way, the numbers go down to a lot smaller. As one bit of anecdotal evidence that may or may not be representative, I had one customer that had found 600 applications. 600 that were not working on anything more current than IE6. So they had 300,000 users, so they get one of those really good VPs. The kind of VP that gets me on an airplane on my first available week. The kind that I wish there were fewer of. So we flew over there, landed, and we were in Bordeaux, France, and we started going through some general rules, and we talked about a rule that will be the very first thing we look at here, that causes things to break. And a light bulb went off on someone's head, and he said, oh, wait, that could mean big things. And he stuck around that night. So we finished off at about 4 o'clock, because it was France, and he stuck around and kept going and kept going. And I assume he stayed until well into the night, because he didn't show up the next day until about 11 o'clock. And he walks in, he's like, all right, that thing you talked about first, yeah, that was all but one of them. They're all good now. I'm like, all right, so here we are, Tuesday, by 11 o'clock. We've gone from 600 broken, I can never leave IE6, to I've got one left. I'm like, well, for God's sake, where is that one? It's like, well, they're up in Nantes. I'm like, all right, let's go. He's like, we'll hop on a plane in the morning. I'm like, wait, it's 11 o'clock. I've got a car, and I would have to drive across the French countryside to get there. I don't think I need to get another airplane. I think that sounds like a perfect little mini vacation. So we drove up to Nantes and debugged it, and it was a really nasty JavaScript issue that had a really annoying cause when we got done, but we fixed it. Now it's Wednesday at about 4:30 in the afternoon. Went from 600 apps can never go to one app that was a pretty hard debug session. I would not expect a beginner to be able to do that one. It was very gnarly. To done in 2 days. And then we were able to start proceeding with that. And, of course, we started proceeding. And they sort of looked at me and said, wow, it's really inconvenient that you're here not speaking French because we'd rather not speak English. So would you mind leaving? We'll SMS you if we need you. I don't tell that story when my manager is around, but I will say this. If you're going to end up someplace in the world where you suddenly have an extra day and a half to yourself, I strongly recommend Bordeaux, France. So that's what we see as fairly representative. In order to get to that stage, it's really important to make sure that you stay focused on what's important and not get distracted by details that don't matter. The formula I like to use is this. Only test the apps when the cost of failure multiplied by the probability of failure justifies ever looking at it. Otherwise, release it. Let them call you if they hit a problem. Don't test it proactively. It doesn't make financial sense. Combine proactive and reactive. Now, I've talked to a lot of customers in Australia, and I got to say, you guys are way, way more advanced in this regard than really all of North America and most of Europe, in that you are already adopting this approach. It seems logical to me. I can't imagine it's controversial. Everyone's like, well, oh, my God, we can't just not test it. And here they're like, yeah, we're doing that. If you're not doing it, consider doing it. It helps things go way faster to be smart about it. I'm going to skip through the compatibility view stuff and show that to you in demo, but I will make one other comment. One of the things that I get into escalations on all the time, my site doesn't work on my IE9, but it works on a vanilla IE9. This is the actual number of possible permutations of the group policies provided by IE9. You know what? We don't have that many unit tests in the IE group. Nearly all of them, no one on the planet has ever seen before. We've added just a few more for IE9 compared to IE8. We've got listings for them. You can see it's basically all these are the new features, so we have new group policies. I can carry them over. But the point I'll emphasize is a blog post that was put up by my friend Aaron Margosis, who works in the U.S. He works with our federal government customers there, talking about sticking with known and proven solutions. And he gives a list here of things to look out for, which may spell trouble for you. You know, things like if the guy who manages your app deployment gets hit by a truck, you'll probably go out of business. If that describes you, you may want to go there. And I've met lots of security guys who live by the philosophy of the more policies I change, the better job I'm doing. Have you met those guys? Because they cause a lot of confusion and a lot of things to break, which wouldn't break if you hadn't mucked around in them. The one policy I would say to be mindful of, because I've seen it cause a lot of challenges along the way, is the policies around zoning. And miszoning is one of the biggest challenges we come across in IE, which is we really flipped two zones. And if you don't consciously make yourself aware of that, you can end up having some unusual decisions. In IE6, what was the most trusted zone we have? More stuff worked in trusted sites than anything else. So you have this now this sort of default answer, well, did you try trusted sites? In IE9, even in IE8, the most trusted zone you have is the local intranet zone. More trusted than trusted sites. So if you have an internal application, put it in trusted sites is actually a pretty bad idea, because not only do you get less trust, you lose your Windows off. So now you're typing passwords and getting fewer permissions. Suddenly that's not sensible. When we thought about it, it was like trusted sites. Well, the word trusted is one of those supercharged words that makes people go, oh, trusted. That's a strong word. I trust that guy. I'll put his site in trusted sites because he seems like a really good guy. There's all these emotional-laden descriptions there. What it's really designed for is, here's a place for my trusted partners to put their stuff. So if I'm using Office 365... I'm going to have online web applications to do collaboration. I trust them, but maybe I don't trust them as much as I trust Bob down the hall, who I know can get fired if he does something really bad. We'll see all this in action, too. The other thing I will point out is when you're talking about IE9, be mindful of HTML5. And how that fits into your platform strategy. And when you think about that, consider the fact that HTML5 is not done. And in some cases is wildly unstable. I've gotten into a number of conversations where, you know, competitive situations, oh, we've got to go with so-and-so browser because they are so aggressive in HTML5. And they pick one of these features that's in the red, that's vacillating wildly, and say, because we have to have this feature, look at what it can do for you. And it can do some really amazing things for you. But it's very unstable. It's changing. And if you invest now in building a lot on top of that platform, guess what's going to happen when the spec changes and therefore browser support changes? Your app's going to be broke and you'll have to fix it. How many of you like fixing apps? That's boring. You want to create new stuff. So we try to divide that into what we consider site-ready HTML5 and what we consider experimental. We still believe in the experimental stuff. This stuff is cool. It just shouldn't be in your browser yet. We put it in our HTML5 lab site. So if you wanted to play with web sockets, you can get the most current implementation up to the latest version of the spec and see what that would do for your app dev environments. But we don't put it on your desktop so that you inadvertently and accidentally end up with a lot of apps based on a dated version of the spec. That is 100% of the slides we're going to look at today. We will not see any more. The rest will be pure demo, because the big focus here is how do we get from wherever we are to wherever we're going. We do so by getting our apps working. How do we get our apps working? We work efficiently on troubleshooting them. And while the specific techniques I teach you, some of them will be reusable, some of them will be very specific, the most important part of troubleshooting is how to focus your thinking on troubleshooting, how to be constantly thinking creatively and narrowing down the problem. What's a hypothesis? Why might this be broken? What tool could I use to figure that out? Some of the tools are really very rudimentary tools. Hypothesis tool, repeat until you've solved the problem. So let's take some broken sites. You know, I know I promised live sites. This one is not a live production site, but the bug itself is pretty important. So I just basically took a bug that I see all the time in real production applications at my customers and reproduced it in a little app. And when I look at this little page, it looks a little bit boring. And the rest of the site doesn't look quite so boring. And so I think to myself, why is that so boring? And if I look at it for a bit of time, I'll notice that the font is Times New Roman. The followed links are all purple. And if I had any unfollowed links, they would be blue. What's the default font for Internet Explorer? Times New Roman. What's the default followed link color? Purple. Default unfollowed? Blue. Aha. I think no one changed the default fonts. Why would that happen? Perhaps they have one of the more common errors, a versioning issue. So the way that I divide the world of the web into, you know, how do you think about the problems, the four main buckets of challenges are problems with versioning, problems with rendering, problems with my script, problems with ActiveX controls. Versioning bubbles to the top of nearly every platform that we rev. It's a big, big problem in IE. It's a big problem in Windows. It's a big problem in Java for people who are trying to no longer run unpatched versions of Java, which is another really terrible idea. We'll talk about that at the Windows 7 session. So versioning is really common. And the tool I can use to see if I have a versioning issue is really fast, really easy, not super, you know, not anything that automatically does anything for you. It just literally is going to say, go look at it. Do you see any conditional comments limiting the version? That's one nice thing about the new source control that's not Notepad, is that it will actually highlight comments, and I can look for the green and go, oh, I have conditional comments that are saying, if IE6, then give me that CSS. And if I'm greater than IE6, and I literally copied this comment directly out of customer code, the customer code that was actively insulting me while I was debugging it for them for free. Ah, you didn't put it in there. Ah, that's not important. Well, that's fantastic. So I've got a couple of different ways that I can experiment with this. I'll show it this way. These are the developer tools in IE. Clearly, we hope that developers will embrace them. If any of you have ever used Firefox and Firebug, that's kind of what we're going after. I think we've beat them in a number of ways. I think they are at least at parity with us in other ways. I have them both. I seldom have to use anything but these for the scenarios that I implement, so I strongly recommend getting comfortable. You don't have to be a dev to use them. In the developer tools, you can go to the HTML tab, say, oh, here's the HTML, and here's the ability to edit the HTML. And, boy, that's not real helpful, because that's not letting me edit the conditional comments. All right. So, let's not use that one. There are limitations. So what can I do instead? Well, I could go on the server, but there are not too many customers I know who are like, oh yeah, here's the password for our server. Go ahead and hop on there. That's not a problem. So what I can do instead is I can use a tool called Fiddler. Fiddler is a tool that's written by Eric Lawrence, who is a senior program manager who owns fundamentals for the browser. He does this in his spare time because he's a nerd, which hopefully we can all appreciate here, and gives it away for free. So fiddler2.com, download it for free, Now you can go in and have this HTTP debugging proxy, which lets me go through and see the conversation that's happening over the web. Now I've made that font awfully big on purpose, but that means we're also kind of scrunched over here. I cleared the cache. You may have noticed me kind of silently doing that because the response I had for this web page was 304. The one you've got is already plenty current. And I wanted to actually edit what was coming back, so I cleared the cache, and that appears to have gone swimmingly, since it's still giving me a 304. So clearly, my cache clearing is not configured the way that I would like it, so we'll just go in and go into Internet Options, delete, and we'll take off preserve favorites and make sure we get absolutely everything out of there. Since that one is a favorite, I will have had that in my cache, and all Fiddler is doing is calling that. Let's clear this off again. Hit refresh, and now we'll get a 200 response. Where is this web page? Here it is. And we can inspect it. We can see what's coming in. If you've never used Fiddler before, this can be useful, but here's what's really cool that you can do with it. I can save the response I got back, and I'll just drop it on my desktop. I'll just call it Forms. And with it on my desktop, I can go and edit it. And I can think about, what could I do to fix this little problem? It's linked in here and says, here's the CSS for IE6, and I didn't put CSS for someone else, and so one option would be I could make a new CSS file. But I don't know that this one's going to fail. So I could just say if it's greater than or equal to IE6. And then, using the magic of Fiddler, I can use the autoresponder. The autoresponder lets me dump a modified page as if it existed on that server without touching the server. Because what we used to have to do was we used to have to copy down the whole website, modify the whole thing so that all the relative links would work, if you've ever done that. That's a pain, number one. Number two, importantly, if you've got scripts running, things on your desktop run in a different zone than things on the internet. So they will behave differently. So not only is it more work, it may not even be accurate. What the autoresponder will do is it will let you plug something in, since it's a proxy, right in the middle. So I can say plug in this modified forms right in the middle. Then when I hit refresh, it'll get the modified version. And it looks like that CSS looks fine. Now, the next thing I would think about, because I'm not just concerned about getting you off of IE6. I'm concerned about getting you never pissed off at your browser or IE again. What's the problem with how I fixed it? It's still tied to IE. What if you decide that you don't want IE anymore? Let's say you wanted to go to Firefox, or you had to support it, or let's say you wanted to run on Safari on your CEO's iPad. There's no technical reason that we know of that this web page would have to break, except we've put instructions in here saying please break. As long as I'm in here mucking with the code anyway, I might as well just get rid of all of it and have it work. That's the ideal. That's what I want to do. I want to get rid of anything that's tying it to a version where I don't have a valid business or technical reason to tie it to a version. Now I am more agile when it comes to this application. Now, in that particular case, that one was tied to IE6. In IE6, we don't have all of the same capabilities that we do for later ones. Why? That ship has sailed. I wish I wish I had a time machine. If I had a time machine, I would certainly go back and say, oh, you know what, we're implementing all these things here back in IE7. Wouldn't it have been nice if we could have lied about being IE7? Wouldn't that have been fantastic? Right? Document modes in terms of rendering, but importantly, browser mode. What does browser mode do? I pulled up a web page from enhanceie.com, which is Eric's web page that he kind of puts his stuff on, and just echoes back what it got as the user agent string from all the different places you can look for version information. And you can see I can switch into a mode where I say, hey, I'm IE8. I can switch into a mode where it says, hey, I'm IE7. I can't switch into a mode where it says, hey, I'm IE6. The DevTools will let me do that, but I can't just set the browser there via any mechanisms via group policy, which is why I had to go in and change that code. So that's versioning. Here's another versioning error. This is a real live production website. I'm always scared this one's going away because I love this example. This is an application. It's called GE Centricity. It's a medical application. And as you can write on the screen right there. And my friend Josh is the director of functional and stereotactic neurosurgery at Northwestern University, which means his brain is full and has no room for web page debugging in it. He's more worried about operating on people's brains. So we have a pretty fair deal. Every time he needs a web page debugged, he calls me. Every time I need my brain operated on, I call him. So it seems pretty fair. So he called me and said, hey, I put on IE9, and this thing is not working. So we got to the prerequisite check, and it's getting up here and saying, oh, your version of MS Script Engine is not sufficient. So now let's go back to that process. Hypothesis tool. How do I think about the problem? You know, I look at that, and I'd be like, it's broken. I don't know why it's broken. In this case, we wanted to debug it so that we could tell the vendor, here's where it's broken. Because you know what the fastest way to get stuff fixed? Submit it debugged. So that they can't come back to you and say, no, it's that guy's problem. So he's like, can you just tell me exactly what they'd have to change so I can submit it debugged? Clearly, they're not responding as quickly as we might like, although it's great for demos. The question was, what's the problem? So we look for the text sufficient, and we find it here, and we find it here. And what I found it easier to do, here we go. Sit here and click through in the script debugger and find the underlying problem. Here's the underlying problem. If the script engine major version is less than 5 or the minor version is less than 5, then say that it's not sufficient. What's the version of the script engine in IE9? Has anyone poked at that? What's that? 9.0. We totally redid it. It's the new Chakra JavaScript engine, 9.0. Is 9 less than 5? Nope, pass. Is 0 less than 5? Yes, fail. Oops. For any of you who don't know, this logic check for 5.1 is exactly why Windows 7 is version 6.1. AppCompat made that decision, not any executive deciding whether it was major or minor. They didn't even get a vote. Because versioning is so problematic. So this is the problem, we think, right? I can sort of reverse my way into it. I think that's the problem. But there are all kinds of times when I'm wrong. So I never want to look at something and go, oh, yeah, I've got that problem solved. So what I wanted to do was to try and drop the right answer in place. So I'm going to look for the checks.js. And it looks like I found it here. Let me just expand that. So this is 10, 59, 39. Yep, there we go. So here I found it. So if I double-click on that, there's actually Fiddler. The latest version has a new syntax view, which actually gives you some syntax highlighting to see it. Here's the underlying JavaScript that's being run. What I can then do is, once again, save the entire response body, and we'll put that as checks.js on the desktop, and we'll close that since we've already found it, and go in and edit that. Look for the text sufficient. And here we go, less than 5 or less than 5. How do you write that correctly? You would write, or I'm going to add an additional set of parentheses in here and say less than 5, that's bad, so we don't get version 4. And then I'm going to add script engine major version equals 5, and the minor version is less than 5. Those are the two conditions you want to fail. Either you're less than 5, that's bad. You're equal to 5, and your minor version is less than 5, that's bad. But 6, that'd be good. 7, 8, 9, now I've written it correctly. In my entire time talking about this, I used to talk about it for Windows all the time. That's where I started. It wasn't until I saw this bug that I brought up this logic problem in IE. I would ask customers when I'd go and sit down and visit with them, how would you write this? And every single one, save one, wrote it incorrectly. Hundreds of people have written the version checking code that caused us to have to make Windows 7 version 6.1. Hundreds. So it's non-trivial. As soon as you realize it's a problem, you're like, oh, now I'm thinking about it. But people aren't stopping and thinking about it. They're going quickly because they're busy. So I'm like, all right, so we can get at that bit of information, and that's pretty helpful. So now let's go back to the autoresponder and add that. And I'm going to replace that with the modified file and see if that works. And drop that in place, checks.js, and save. And now let's see if we've gotten any better here. We'll run, got our fingers crossed. I was all excited. I thought I'd fix that problem really quickly. And then, oh, I got it wrong. So then I had to think to myself, did I get it wrong? So I'm back in Fiddler going, how did I get that wrong? Is that coming in? And then I noticed something. You may have noticed it when I poked at it. The actual URL has a query string with the date and time that you asked for it. And every single time it gives you a new one. Which means this exact match is never going to match it again. So I haven't actually tested my logic because I didn't feed it back. I could make it a regular expression and say everything that starts with checks.js, regardless of query string, replace that. And now we pass that check. I was right. That's the right version number. It's going to try to install ActiveX controls. At this point, I don't have a lot of confidence in their ability to write good code. So I'm going to go ahead and decline to install them and say I fixed your number one problem. You can try installing the controls. The challenge we have is there's not a setting I can put on there. So while I could intercept it on his machine using Fiddler, or I could even build an application because Eric has released a new, basically a little SDK called the Fiddler Core, that you could write an app that would auto-replace that for you. But he's like, you know, we use this to inspect radiology images that we use to determine health of people. I'm going to go ahead and wait for a supported version from the vendor. Even though you think you got it right, I'll give this to them. Hopefully that'll accelerate it. But unfortunately, I'm not going to take your little hacky fixes. I'm going to actually ask that we get it right. Versioning, and we'll kind of go into standards now. So this is a web page that I debugged for the rock group Motley Crue, who will actually be here in Australia later on in September. If I were still here, I would be going. I saw them. It turns out that if you debug the band's website for free, and you're right, that You can tweet Nikki Sixx, their bassist, and he'll give you a code to get you really awesome seats at their shows. Just a helpful tip. You still have to pay for them, but I got a really good, helpful little code. So I looked at this. This is, you know, for a crew, and I looked at that, and I'm like, oh, you know, that looks familiar, right? Times New Roman, blue, purple, those are all the default colors, so I'm thinking that that's probably a versioning thing. What tool can I use for that? We'll go look at it. Here's all the CSS. There are no version vectors. All right, so that theory's out. Now I've got to think of another theory. I went fishing. I didn't have another theory. I went over to the console mode, and I hit refresh and said, is there any output that would explain to me why that CSS wasn't being processed? And pointed me to it really quickly. DevTools are great for stuff like that. We've ignored it due to a MIME type mismatch. All right, so I'm not getting CSS, and I've got warnings saying CSS is being ignored. I'm guessing they're probably related. So in order to figure out what was going on, I figured, well, I could use the network tools here. In fact, I may as well. Let me explain how they work here. Go figure that a very fiddler-like experience would appear in a tool created and run by the guy who makes Fiddler. Notice that, you know, here's the request headers, here's the request body, here's the response headers. MIME type does not match. The MIME type is called as the header, the content type. It's saying this CSS is not telling me it's CSS. Looks to me like it is. But one thing I can guarantee you I don't know is every single last detail of all of the specs that go into HTML. So what did I do? I looked it up. What's the rule? Okay, type slash subtype, so I've got text slash CSS, semicolon parameter, and parameter is attribute equals value. So type slash subtype, semicolon, attribute equals value. Type slash subtype good, semicolon, nope, don't have one of those, that's wrong. Parameter equals value, nope, that's not equals, that's a colon. It's actually not standards compliant. And if I go in and edit that so that I put a semicolon and I put an equal sign, it turns out that that works. But I'm in the process of getting there quickly. All right, I'm in the enterprise. I have these apps. I'd like them to work as fast as I can. If I was dealing with a public website, I'd want them to fix that, because I'm not going to have control or influence over all of those. If I'm dealing with a lot of external devices that are using IE9, I'd do those. What I would do instead is say, that's more standards compliant. We have four sets of rules for how we interpret standards in the browser, four of them. It's literally like having four browsers. You have all of them, and it's not just a few branches here and there, it's the whole engine. We have Quirks mode, which is carried on from IE 5.5. IE 7 standards, we kept that one when we went to IE 8. IE 8 standards, we kept that when we went to IE 9, and then you have IE 9 standards. As a general rule, if we're implementing a security feature, we'll put it in all of them. If we are implementing a standards compliant feature, we'll put that in the new one. Which means, if you don't want to be bound by us being much harsher on the rules, don't opt into the latest rendering engine. So while I could go and apply and be very strictly following the rules, it's probably faster for me to simply say, go back to the rules in IE8 where you worked, and guess what? The application works again. That's one of the decisions to make. Where am I going to be a stickler for working in the latest and greatest rendering engine, and where am I going to just let it run and wait until they give me a new version? My personal preference is to say, for anything I already have, keep it working. Don't insist on being a perfectionist. There are enough things that will still break that you'll have work to do, right? Unless any of you are like, you know, I got way too much time on my hands. I'm going to intentionally break some stuff by insisting that stuff that's 4 years old complies with today's standards. Most people don't live in a world like that. Most people in a world like, I just need to get my stuff working so I can at least get there. And then I can say, yeah, next time, update it. And I can put a rule that says, you know, hey, our quality standards for new apps in our environment are you must run in at least 8, if not 9. But the old stuff, if it runs in 7, leave it there. If it runs in quirks, leave it there. And importantly, if you're touching it anyway, you can put a tag, that XUA compatible header or meta tag, that says where you work. And if you do that, the next version of the browser can read that and do a much better job of keeping you working by keeping you in that engine. True statistics. Remember that 25% going down to like around 3% or so at the beginning? Kind of gives you a little warm fuzzy. IE8 to IE9. I have so far worked with 17 customers doing that transition. How many bugs do you think that I have found? What percent or number that have not worked in IE9, that worked in IE8, that could not be fixed using a compatibility view? Anyone have a guess? Zero? Not quite zero. Two. We just saw one of them. The centricity web was one. That's half of the bugs that I've not been able to fix going from 8 to 9 that you've already seen. And the other one was a DirectX filter being applied to a table to do a drop shadow that sort of, the, you know, since we made it a DirectX app, then that sort of fundamentally changed how it works. And that's it. No other bugs not fixed. If they tagged this website, run me in IE8 mode, it would have never broken. Customer after customer, app after app, if they're going from 8 to 9 and they've tagged them, they all just work. And they go really fast. If they don't tag them and they end up in 9 mode, then they end up demoting them. If you're going and demoting them anyway, leave them tagged so they continue to work in the future. Another app. This is another public. You can, all these URLs, you can go there. These are not made up by me. They're all on the public internet. So someone posted about this one saying, hey, this app doesn't work. This is a, you know, kind of a versioning, but it kind of really goes into the whole concept of this XUA compatible tag and getting it working in the right environment. Here's an app that's actively saying, oh, gee, looks like your browser sucks. Try any other browser. Those are all good. So the question comes in, what's going on here? What are you doing to do this check for me? And if I start looking through and digging and seeing, you know, all the logic that's being applied to say, hey, is everything working? And in essence, it boils down to a little check that happens here. Get element by ID. Right, this is like the fundamental AJAX API. Find an element and do something with it. If the element didn't get created, you know things are bad. Here's how they check to see if it'll work. This little element is an HTML5 canvas element. So like, all right, create this HTML5 canvas, try to find it. If not, assume you must be IE because any good browser would work. And go on to advertise for every other browser that there is. We love that, by the way. So then we're like, all right, I'm on IE9, so I support canvas elements. So what turns out to be the problem? Oh, isn't that interesting? 4 distinct rendering engines, whole monolithic chunks of code that say how to render stuff. Did we do HTML5 in IE7? No. So here's what they did. Please behave like IE7. And then come along later and say, oh, it looks like you're IE7. That sucks. I'm not going to run. I'll tell you to go get into another browser. because they've opted into a rendering engine that doesn't support HTML5 despite needing HTML5. So while I strongly advocate tagging, be aware of what these tags mean. You're choosing a rendering engine. What people interpret this as all the time when they quickly read the documentation, they say, oh, if it's not compatible, if it's not working, try this. And therefore, they intuit that this is the work better switch. And who doesn't want their app to work better? If they had simply not put that, then what would have happened is that they would have defaulted to IE9 standards. And IE9 standards, that would, of course, start up. It would then initially complain, hey, it looks like you're Internet Explorer, and therefore you suck, because that's sort of the default behavior of the application. And then it'll work. Holy crap. It was not working because they asked it not to work. So you've got to be mindful of what you're doing. And this is problematic in the enterprise especially, because guess what the default is if you don't mark it in the local intranet zone? IE7 compatibility. So if you want to fiddle around with HTML5 and you don't put a XUA compatible, please give me 9, and you're on http://whack/whack server name, it's not going to work until you go in and say, I need the 9 engine because I'm doing HTML5 stuff. Or in this case, it's the inverse. They asked for an engine that they knew that they wouldn't work with or most likely intercepted. I found that most people aren't actually malicious. They just don't have the patience to figure it out, which is why, you know, one of the things I try to do is simplify the message. We've got this amazing compatibility infrastructure. I think we've oversimplified it in some ways by making it a button, because a single button can't very well get you between 4 modes. Oh, and guess how many we've got in IE10? 5 of them. Single button won't help you navigate through 5 of them any better. If you understand what they're doing, get much better use of the platform. Rendering, XUA compatible tags, all that's really important. Here's another one. This one just came in. This is from a website that they're using to solicit proposals to come and talk at an event. This one literally was this morning that I did the debugging on this one. They said, yo, if you happen to be wanting to use this with IE9 or IE, use one of the compatibility modes to get it to work. Or it's probably easier to just use another browser. We've got this text that's going up here saying, oh, you know, that's kind of hard for me to read. I can't scroll up anywhere. There is no more to go. And turns out submissions don't really work. If we go in here, notice that they're saying it works in all of the other browsers, which are very standards compliant. It's not working so well in ours, which can be standards compliant, or which also can be compatible, and they're defaulting to Quirks mode. What's going on? They've put in this little HTML 4.0 when transitional, a very old spec, as their doc type. There's this little matrix on doc type. If I'm using HTML 4 transitional, URL not present, standards mode will be off. Aha! I've put an old doc type for whatever reason. I don't get standards mode for that doc type because I've not included the URL in it, which means I get Quirks. IE is the only one that has this IE5.5 compatibility for this ancient spec. How do I fix it? Drop it in anything more current. And as soon as I get into standards mode, the layout goes back to, I appear to be not hitting it over the internet right now, the layout, oh, there we go, goes back to what it would look like on another browser. So it's literally a misunderstanding of, I just probably copied and pasted a doc type from somewhere without thinking of the implications of what that would cause. And I would fix that by putting in a modern doc type or doing something different. Here's another layout issue. Another real application, which I'll show here because I'm guessing most of you probably would have a hard time reading it. And they pointed to this and said, that is not okay. And I'm like, all right, can you tell me what the heck's going on there? Because I've got no clue. Like, that is on two lines. And that is not okay. It doesn't lay out in two lines in IE8. It does in IE9. And technically, it's not broken. The app still works. It just doesn't meet the expectations of the designers who had something in particular in mind. So we took a look at this and again used the developer tools to say, why are you laying out differently? And we looked at it and saw, okay, what are we doing for the size here? And if I look at this, here's a table def for this guy, and it's going to have various attributes that describe what it looks like, and here it's saying the width is 3%. And what turns out to be happening is they've gone through and opened this window at a defined width. And then they went through and said, well, 3% of this number of pixels would be this, and this all works great. And, oh, but I'm doing this in, you know, GDI, and then we go over into Direct2D, and then we get into subpixel rendering because we've got clear type rendering. It turns out that in the end, on IE9, with Direct2D rendering and with clear type, the actual size of this, 3% divided by the 1024 wide that it is, ends up being 0.26 pixels too wide because of subpixel rendering. And we reflow it. And if you look at what the rules are, they're using an HTML table. An HTML table not only says, you know, oh, you know, the width is not guaranteed, it actually promises. If you don't fit, the user agent, aka the browser, might choose to reflow that. So here's the design expectation. Tables never reflow. Here's the definition of a table. Tables reflow. So what's the problem? I'm using the wrong kind of element. So in their case, yes, we could go through and tweak it by another couple of pixels, but the right solution is stop using a table. Because table's not the right construct for you. How are we doing? We need a breather? Are we doing enough hardcore geek action for you? I cough, that's all I got. We're all sleeping here. It's hard to sleep up here. It's very bright. I can't really see you too well. So I'm hoping we're continuing to do well. But this is the kind of the way that we think about these problems. Here's another one. Easily the most common problem I see. Remember that 25% to 3%? Remember the story about how I got to spend a day and a half drinking red wine in France and eating baguettes? This is the problem. IE6 has a little bug. And by a little bug, I mean a bug that's the bane of my existence. Here's IE6's bug. In IE6, we actually have two rendering engines available. Because in the transition between 5.5 and 6, we had to fix a little bit of a problem, which was the rules changed. For how you measure an object. They changed because we weren't standards compliant. Here's how the rules used to be. The rules used to be, as implemented by IE, so I'm going to make that blue so you can see it. Blue is the old way. What's the height of an object? The height of an object is the size of the object plus its padding. The width is the width of an object plus its padding. Which, if you think about it, kind of makes sense, right? Let's say you were designing a door that I could fit through. right? So I have a width plus a variable amount of padding depending upon how long I've been in a conference, right? It gradually increases over the course of the week. So if I were designing a door, I would want a door to fit me plus whatever padding I've put on. Makes sense, except standards don't say that. The standards say, no, it's just you, just your skeleton, right? If you want to make a door that fits you and your corpulence, you'll have to also add in the value of the padding. That's what they say. It was one of those things where we had kind of said, this makes sense. They said, that makes sense. The standards body accepted the other one. So now we're wrong. As you might imagine, when suddenly you say that everything that used to be, you know, look at the height of this one, 151 plus 150, used to be 300 tall, and now it's 150 tall, that might cause a couple layout problems, right? So in order to not break every application that you had, we said, we're going to default to the old way. And then the developer can opt in and throw a doc type tag in and say, no, I don't want the old way, I want the new way. So now it's intentional. The developer chooses that. And how do they indicate that they want the new way? They do so by adding this doc type directive. If it has a doc type, then run it in standards. If it doesn't, then run it in what we started to call quirks. But basically IE5.5 compatibility. So far, so good. Here's a little problem. IE6 does not read that doc type if it's not the very first line of markup in the source code. What flavor of HTML is that? XHTML. It was kind of popular for a while. What's the first line of markup in XHTML? The XML declaration. What's the second line? The doc type. Does IE6 read that doc type? No. So what does IE6 render that page in? Quirks. Now we fixed that bug because you can't very well have the switch that puts you into standards compliance mode not itself be standards compliant. Or you get this paradox that sort of causes the universe to implode, and we actually called that paradox IE6. So we fixed that bug, and guess what we did in doing so? We took all of these pages that were running in quirks mode that have this totally different way of measuring their objects, and we promoted them to standards mode. And it turns out that nearly all of them would break even in IE6 on standards mode if it weren't for the fact that IE6's bug was keeping them in quirks mode. We didn't break them in 7, 8, or 9. We broke them in 6. They just got lucky because we had a little bug that then fixed them again. At that customer in France, it was all but one of their applications. I had another customer where it was 80% of their failing applications were caused by that. The average is between 85 and 90% of failing applications that worked on 6, don't work on 7 and above, are all because we fixed that bug. I would love to, you know, I've literally asked, I said, if you could give me an IE6 compatibility mode that does nothing but put that bug back, I get to see my family a whole lot more. So how do we fix that? Well, I can obviously test that pretty easily by dropping into quirks mode. So here's a page that's not laying out so great. I click on quirks mode, and now, oh, that's what it looked like on IE6. This one needs quirks mode. But then if you think about running the enterprise, I don't know that the directions of push F12 to open the developer tools, and then navigate over to this little drop-down here and click quirks mode and then start using your website is going to go down real well with your end users. Unless they're very, very patient. How can I distribute that to everyone? Well, one way is I could go in and remove that doc type from the code. If there's no doc type, then I'll get quirks mode again. But then I'm touching the code. It's the most expensive way to do it, page by page. Another option would be to add the XUA compatible meta tag. I'm still then adding it to every single page. Easier, if it's affecting a whole website, would be to add an XUA compatible header So I can just drop it and say the web.config of IIS so that it just automatically includes that, saying, hey, you just get quirks and just touch the individual web servers. Way easier than touching every individual page, particularly dynamically generated ones. Another alternative is that we added a group policy. Under compatibility view, there's a new policy saying use policy list of quirks mode sites. So now you can just say this guy gets quirks mode, rather than just what we used to have, which was just use a policy list of IE7 sites. So I can do it via group policy, I can do it via the header, I can do it via the meta tag, I can do it by editing the page and removing the doc type until I update it, or to update the page to actually be compatible with standards. This policy is in IE9, it's baked in. I did get Windows Sustained Engineering to take the bug for IE8, but they did not accept it as a GDR, what's called a general distribution release. So in order to get it, if you're trying to go to IE8 and save yourself some time by having it via policy, you have to install a hotfix. There's a hotfix available for 8. It's built into 9. You can do group policy support. You can add the header. You can add the meta tag. You can remove the doc type. As granular or as broad as you need to go, we have solutions to help make that faster. This is the low-hanging fruit that lots and lots of people miss. Here's another example of a website that does something very similar. We can go through and fix that very easily also, drop it to quirks, and now we've gotten our expense reporting application working again. I have 3 more minutes. I don't know if I have time to actually debug anything interesting. I can do a scripting one. So here's an application that is popping a window, and it's opening up, and it's doing something. It doesn't seem to be getting there very quickly. And when I was troubleshooting this one, the basis upon which I created this example, because I couldn't just walk out of the customer with the application, I ran on my machine so I could notice this. It's a script, and it's sitting there filling up the CPU. I need to interpret that. What do you think that means? I'll give you a hint. I have 4 cores on my computer. I'm at about 25%, which means one of them is full bore. What causes one CPU to go full bore? This was a hint. Infinite loop. All right. I'm in an infinite loop. Infinite loop, that's probably in a script. Let me see if I can grab that in a debugger. So here's where I can use the debugging tools. Even if I'm not a developer, this will at least let me go and look at where am I going. Go and I'll just break into a debugger and see, oh, yep, here's what we're doing. On the window document, element by ID equals null, semicolon. So it's basically going to loop on this forever. Does this exist? Is it here? 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 Asking forever, burning up my CPU as we go. If I right-click and add it to my watch, I can see entry frame. Oh, it appears to exist with one slight difference. Capital F, lowercase f. And if I look up, get element by ID. I like to go to the MSDN docs because the MSDN docs, unlike the W3C docs, will tell you about the various modes. And oh, this has this little keyword here, IE8 mode and later. All right. Case sensitive match. Ooh. Rendering. We apply new rules of rendering for current rendering engines. We also apply new rules for scripts for standards compliance to new rendering engines. It's case sensitive now. We fixed it to be standards compliant. Ooh, that's fantastic. If I had greater than 30 seconds left, I would have gone and debugged that, but my apologies if anyone's let down. So we'll go back and refresh that and say, you know what? If the rules of IE7 were in place, it could now no longer be, it would now be case insensitive, which is kind of what I want, and now the script would work. So with that, I know we kind of were pummeling you with demo after demo, debugging after debugging after debugging, but hopefully what I was able to instill in you was the process, the thought process. What do I know about the web? What can I find out in my web browser? Because I was doing an awful lot of internet searches, as you may have noticed. And how do I do the process? Hypothesis tool, even if it's a primitive tool. Until I get to the answer, you can solve an unbelievable number of problems, and being disciplined is very helpful. In the end, getting there effectively is taking good people who can think clearly about the business problems and the technology problems, giving them a good process, and giving them the best tools is the most effective way to do app compat. With that, I'd like to thank you all for coming. It is now lunchtime, so now you can soak up what remains of last night's alcohol, and I will hopefully see some of you at my Windows 7 session in the afternoon. Thank you very much.